a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
So we have Lieutenant Governor Dennis Dugard with us. Governor?
Thank you and good morning. I just thought I would begin today. I know that a number of you have been following our efforts to restore power in north central South Dakota after the ice storm. And I thought I'd give you just a real brief update on that, just kind of where we're at. As of last evening, which is the last time that we took a count, and the Emergency Operations Center is still in operation, we had about 2,500 people that were still without power. That's down from about 12,000 at the height of the storms. REA officials say that right now the number of poles that are down is about 5,500 that they've counted so far. They continue to find more poles down as they get into some of the more rural areas. Restoration efforts continue with nearly 700 individuals actively engaged in bringing the power back up. And this is, you know, as you know, there are working arrangements between REAs from different parts of the country, and they brought in a lot of folk with their equipment to try to expedite bringing the power back up in this massive ice storm. Tri-County Rural Water is pumping some water at this time. This is the rural water system that serves the Cheyenne River reservation, along with a number of counties west of there, and their pumping facility is back in operation. They had lost power on it, and then they had the unfortunate circumstances of actually having a pump fail at one of their facilities, and that's now back and operating, and they are now beginning to pump water. It'll take some time for them to fill the pipe and to get it back out to the farthest reaches, but the good news is that they do have their facilities working again. The most recent count is that we still have 20 shelters that are open. There are an additional 13 that are on standby. Sometime later on this afternoon, we'll probably have a better count about how many people are there. The number of people that are actually being helped in the shelters is dwindling as the power is being restored. National Guard currently has 88 members that are on active duty and involved in the restoration efforts. We've had about 140 members overall since the beginning of this emergency that have actually participated. They're all volunteer. They've come in, helped, and then others have stepped in and replaced them. We've had nine of their dozers that we've been using to push through some of the snow areas to get the power trucks up to where the actual down lines are at. We've got one front-end loader and two water tanks that have also been moving water into areas where the pumps have failed. So for any individuals that would like to help, and I know that there's been a discussion about assistance to the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, this is an area where, as I think most people in South Dakota recognize, there's a real challenge because we've got folks that have a tough time finding employment to begin with in that area, and there's not a lot of wealth there to begin with. So when they do run into an emergency situation like this, there's a real need for assistance for these people. And for anybody that would like to help in terms of offering additional assistance, the Cheyenne River Emergency Management offices are available. And I'll give you a number for them just in case there's nonprofit organizations or individuals that would also like to help them out. Their number is 605-964-7711, and they would most certainly appreciate any additional assistance that they can receive as well. With that, I'll open it up. If you've got any questions for me, I'll start with that. And as you know, it was a shortened legislative week this week. The ice storm not only took its toll with power, but it also delayed the travel plans for a lot of legislators. We had, you know, zero visibility conditions, and the legislature and the leadership last week, I think, made the right choice in deciding to get out of here a little bit early and then to delay the Monday session until late into the afternoon. That allowed their members to travel more safely down and back, and I think it was the right move to make. It's also that time of the year in which the formalities of getting the bills through the process and getting the legal notices out so that the public knows what the bills are and what they're working on so that they've got time to prepare for a trip to peer to offer testimony or to contact their legislators. That's a large part of what happens right now as they begin the process of putting in their ideas into bill form. So I think they're in pretty good shape. We haven't seen a lot of bills coming through so far, but I understand that their staff has been very busy trying to put everything together for what we expect to be a normal run of bills comparable to what we have in most years. With that, Lieutenant Governor Dugard is here as well, and if you have questions for either of us, we'd be happy to respond.
Governor, I'm curious if you watched the State of the Union last night and if you saw anything in there that's particularly relevant for South Dakota.
I did have the opportunity to view the State of the Union. I think President Obama did a very good job of articulating his point of view. On several occasions, I found myself agreeing with him and welcoming his suggestion that nuclear power was a critical part of our energies or our nation's future energy needs. I think that that recognition is critical to actually being able to provide us with another source of energy that is long overdue. I will share with you that. I was a little bit disappointed in that we didn't have a discussion about ethanol or about the need for the biofuels. And I thought there might be something in there about the need to move to E15 across the country. I had hoped that that might happen. And I think the suggestion that Washington, D.C., in his terms, wasn't really working the way most people in America want it to work. I think that's what everybody is saying to begin with. And I think the fact that he mentioned it last night brings more attention to that. I think it's not surprising to me that he has indicated a desire to continue with health care reform. I think the real issue, and this does impact people in South Dakota. We had as high as 93% of our people with a plan for health care. I think we're down to about 91 right now as this recession has now entered its third year. I don't think they've got the right idea about how to fix it yet. And we've had the opportunity to work with members in the White House, and we've shared with staff members and with lawmakers in D.C. that we don't think by putting more people on the government plan is necessarily the way to take care of health care needs. I still believe that reforming the industry, reforming the practices is the right way to go. I think we ought to do, in a lot of cases, we ought to be doing what we've already done in South Dakota. We ought to require portability where you can move from one group to another group without worrying about pre-existing conditions. I think you ought to have guaranteed renewability built into your plans so that if you have an individual plan, you have to be able to expect that you're going to get offered renewal. And then you have to have rate stabilization and that the banding has got to be set up such that you can't simply charge more for somebody because they have pre-existing conditions or because they've been with the plan for a longer period of time. You shouldn't have to undergo new physicals or new healthcare questions when you renew an insurance policy. And I think there has to be a place where individuals that are uninsurable can enter the private market. And I think that's one place where uninsurable pools, like we have here in South Dakota, can be successful. And I also think that people coming off Medicaid should automatically be eligible, or if they've been entered into a workforce, if they apply for a group policy, I don't think there should be any pre-existing conditions held against them in that transition over. That would help to move them off of Medicaid, and would help to transition them into the private market. And I think those would go a long ways towards allowing more people to keep their insurance and to have reasonable rates in the future. I know that both the Republican and Democrats have suggested that there has to be the ability to sell insurance across state lines. I can't find anybody that can show me where that's not being done now, because in South Dakota, a lot of our insurance companies that sell in South Dakota come from other states, and they can sell across state lines, just like you do auto insurance or homeowners insurance and so forth. And so I'm not really sure where they're getting that information in some states where they're not allowing them to do that. But it's just a matter of you have to follow the state guidelines in each state, just like you do for auto insurance for homeowners. And that means then that you can also critically review the activity of insurance companies to make sure that they're properly paying claims. And that has to stay at the state level. You can't have a federal bureaucracy trying to make decisions about appropriate delivery of health care through an insurance company. It takes too long. Whereas if you're talking about state agencies, they get in and get problems fixed very, very rapidly. In fact, in South Dakota, it happens within a notification can go out within 24 hours about review of somebody that's been denied a procedure and that kind of stuff. So I think there's things that we can do, and I hope that we continue to work towards having health care reform, but it's got to be one that works long-term. It's got to be one that actually takes people off government-run health care programs. That would actually be a cost savings to government. But I noted that the president indicated, or at least that the plan that they had offered would save money. Part of it was because they would put more people on Medicaid, and Medicaid only pays between 50 and 52% of the health care cost, the actual cost or the billed charges. What they really struggle with is understanding that when Medicaid only pays about half of the billed charge, that gets cost shifted back to everybody else who has their own plan. And so employers who pay health care for their employees end up with a bigger bill because the cost shifting that goes on because people go on to Medicaid is significant. And that's not being recognized. And in the plans that we saw coming out of both the House and the Senate, neither of them recognize any inflation in health care between now and 2019. You have to recognize inflationary factors. Otherwise, that's going to get passed on to everybody else as well. So I hope they continue to work at it, but I think they should be focusing on private market sectors rather than a government-run plan. I also think, in reviewing the State of the Union last evening, I think the president made a serious mistake when he suggested to Congress and the American people a chastisement of the United States Supreme Court for their interpretation of a statute on campaign finance and its constitutionality. That is their job. And I think there has to be a recognition of deference to the court when they do their job. And I think that could have been done perhaps in a more appropriate fashion without a direct chastisement of these Supreme Court members doing the best job that they could. Remember, the law that was put in effect was put in effect by Congress, and it has to meet constitutional measures. If it didn't, that's not the Supreme Court's fault. It simply means that Congress should go back in and take a second look at how to appropriately meet constitutional guidelines. And that shouldn't be something that the Supreme Court should have been chastised for. I just didn't think that was appropriate. Other than that, I think the recognition that there has to be bipartisanship in Congress is something that you always strive for. You hope that they can come around a little bit. I tell people that, you know, if Congress actually had a time frame in which they had to get things done, kind of like our legislature does here in South Dakota. Think about this for a second. Our legislature meets for not more than 40 days. They come in, they do the work of the people, then they live with what they've done the rest of the year. But they leave and go back home again, and they understand because they have to live with what's going on in the real world. If our Congress at the federal level had an obligation to get work done on a timeline and didn't just do continuing resolutions, but if they had to get their work done and then come back and live with what they've done and actually take time away, come back in here rather than being in and out and things going on for years at a time, I think that's what our founding fathers wanted in the first place. I think they wanted them to come in to do their work, allow the executive branch to then execute, and then to come back in and correct the following year. I really think that's what they had in mind, and in some fashion, that's what should go on today.
Governor, this is Al Vanzi at KVN in yes, Rapid sir. City. Do you agree with the Supreme Court's ruling that corporations should be able to make unlimited spending in campaigns?
Al, I really think that what the court said was is that the laws that are in effect today were unconstitutional. But I think the bigger issue is why not simply have full and complete disclosure about who's doing what? If like in South Dakota, we allow folks to donate, and we've got some reasonable individual donation or limitations. But the big thing for us, the one that I think is the most important, is before elections, things get disclosed. And if people know who's supporting who, and if they can go back in and they can figure out why someone is supporting a candidate or a particular cause or who's behind it, that adds a lot to the discussion. And I really think that reform efforts should focus more on getting the disclosures out about who's behind the money, what their real purpose is, what the hidden agendas are. I think that does as much, because the American people aren't stupid. And once they figure that out, once they figure out who's doing it and why they're doing it, that I think was going to have a whole lot more in terms of implications about why people want particular actions to occur or they want particular people in office. And so it doesn't mean that Congress can't come in and find a way after the court decision is analyzed to put appropriate limitations in place. But it looks like, and I believe it was a 5-4 decision, the impact was, and what they were saying was, is you've gone too far in terms of restricting specifically these corporations. And can they find a way to get around it? I think they can, but they just simply have to rewrite their law and do it correctly based on information they receive in this court decision.
Which South Dakota laws, Governor, are going to go down as a result of this precedent now set in the Supreme Court?
I have not had a discussion with anybody concerning the South Dakota laws that might be impacted by it. I really can't tell you which ones would be today. That might be, and that may very well have to be a discussion that we have with the Attorney General and with the Secretary of State after they've done their analysis.
Governor Dave Lombeck, I'm sorry.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. I was just looking at an article the other day, and it talked of 32 of the 33 developed nations have universal health care, the U.S. being the exception. 15 of those, about half of those, are single payer. And I was just wondering, what do those countries know that we don't, or what are they doing that we're not? Are they doing? I mean, obviously, there are that many countries in that kind of a system. It must be working for them.
I think part of it is a culture under which their expectations are managed. If you talk with people in Canada, they'll tell you that some things are fine as long as you expect that it may take you 6 months to get in to see a doctor. If you have an emergency, you head south of the border and you head to places like Rochester or Fargo or Sioux Falls. As long as you know that you may very well have to do that and you've got the resources to do it, then fine. But I think it might surprise you to find out just how many Canadians actually head into the United States where there is a private health care system available and actually get their emergency care done here, because it does not exist to the same extent in Canada as what it does in the United States. So it doesn't mean that you can't make improvements if you trust that your government will be making the appropriate decisions for you. We have a plan in the United States that it's Medicare. Medicare has proven to be a fairly successful approach to a government-sponsored plan, but you have to recognize that one of the reasons why it's working is because everybody else shoulders the hidden costs for Medicare in terms of paying a higher premium. It's a hidden tax on everybody else. You also have to recognize that in some cases, and I know that Mayo Clinic just announced this week that the government-run program of Medicare is not adequate to take care of their needs in Arizona, and they're no longer accepting Medicare patients beginning next week. So, it's based upon what your expectations are. And in the United States, I think we've got a pretty good plan in terms of high tech and high-valued healthcare being delivered. And it's one that people from other countries come in to participate in. We don't have the culture of waiting for an extended period of time to see a doctor, unless you're on an Indian reservation. If you're on an Indian reservation and you have government-run Indian health care, then in some cases you may very well wait for days to see a doctor, and I don't think anybody feels that's appropriate either. And so Let's just take a look at where the successes are for health care, at least in our country, and it most certainly is not Indian health care. And if you look at Medicaid and you look at the cost shifts going on right there, that wouldn't exist if you didn't have a private health care system up there with employers that are paying larger numbers than what they otherwise would have to subsidize it with a hidden cost shift. And I believe the same thing occurs with Medicare, or you would not have doctors out there telling us that they won't accept Medicare patients anymore. And in South Dakota, we actually have doctors right now that say we only accept so many Medicaid patients because we can't afford to do business if we're accepting more. We have to have the private sector subsidizing them with paying higher premiums, paying higher prices.
Jackie at KDLT, I have two questions about two bills moving forward in legislature, changing sex offender laws and the alcohol sales.
I'm sorry, say, the first one is what?
Changing the sex offender law.
Okay.
And the alcohol sales, moving to every day, any day.
I understand that there has been a summer committee that has looked at changing the status on some tiers of sex offenses. I normally don't decide whether or not I will sign legislation until I've looked at it, but I think the review of that particular one is very appropriate. What they finally come up with, I do not know. I know that it's in the middle of a process, and this is one that a lot of legislators will have different points of view on. So before I tell you I support a particular bill, I really want to see it in its final form. But I do think that a review of how we've put that in place is appropriate at this time. What was the other one that you asked about?
The alcohol sales being any day, every day.
Personally, I don't have a problem with it. If the legislature decides what the hours of operation are, the legislature also decides how many days, which days, and so forth. I don't see it as a major problem. I think it's it'll probably depend upon what the final form on it is, but I personally don't have strong feelings on it either way.
Governor, on the subject of, you mentioned Indian health, you also talked about the storm earlier. I talked with the chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and he said, he mentioned that they're having issues not just with the immediate relief, trying to get the power and the water back on, but they have long-term infrastructure issues. He said the homes they have up there, which now don't have heat, or didn't have heat, or don't keep the cold wind out, said their water system is 50 years old and was given a 25-year lifespan, which is part of why there's been so much trouble getting it back up. And he said the serious need for long-term reform there, and obviously a lot of that shared with the federal government. But I'm wondering what role, if any, you think South Dakota has in helping them not just get back on their feet, but get in a better situation so that disasters like this don't hit them like this again.
We've participated with them in the Tri-County Rural Water, or the rural water system that actually feeds their water system with good, clean water out of the Missouri River. And I think that was a very good partnership. And I think in those areas we can continue to work with them. And it's interesting because recognize that you have a sovereign tribe, but it's on a reservation established by federal directive and by a federal government that really acts kind of like a nanny in a way. They take land and they put it into trust. And I think in a lot of cases, a lot of Native Americans will tell you that it's a good thing to have, and yet I have often said that until such time as you fix the reservation systems and allow for economic development to occur, allow for businesses to be able to come in and to actually establish and to make it simpler than what it is right now, you're not going to have economic activity on the reservations. And right now, if you take a look at who the major employers are on the reservations, they're not private. They are federally subsidized. The tribes are directly dependent on the federal government for assistance. And if you don't have an economy, if you don't have a local economy, if you're not creating something, if you can't establish a business and own the structures, it makes it really difficult to create new jobs and to create a place where young people can come back to. And it truly does need to have a different approach if it's ever going to have a better economy than what it does today. But that as the governor of South Dakota, these individuals are South Dakota residents. But I do not have law enforcement capabilities on the reservation, and we truly don't have the ability to directly impact the decisions on governance on the reservations because the tribes are sovereign. And so it becomes a struggle because you can act as a partner, but you can't really make the changes that as an outsider looking in you think might work. It really has to come from the citizens saying, it's time to make a change. We want things to change. And you know, government, federal government is a long ways away, and they're not close to the people that are there. It is, I think, one of the most frustrating things that we ever try to deal with in terms of trying to make things better on the reservations when we really don't have the tools available to us to make that happen. And what's really frustrating about it is I don't see that changing as long as the attitude is that the federal government controls most of the activity and most of the funding on the reservations. It makes it very difficult for local leaders to be able to do long-term planning. When they're only allowed enough dollars for infrastructure to just get by, then they really never are able to put away money for making changes, for making the improvements, for doing the long-term planning, because it's always based upon whether or not there's federal money available. And I suspect that many of your tribal elected leaders would perhaps share the same feeling of frustration that we do in dealing with the federal government.
Jonathan Ellis with the Argus Leader. I actually have a question for Lieutenant Governor Dugard. There's a concurrent resolution which opposes both the House and Senate health care bills, and then there's a Senate bill which seeks to nullify some federal health care issues in the state of South Dakota. And I'm wondering, sir, what your take is on those efforts.
Jonathan, could you describe them again? I'm not sure.
There's a Senate bill, Senate Bill 137, which nullifies any health care bill which imposes a tax or fee or fine under the 9th and 10th Amendment. And then there's also a concurrent resolution which opposes both the Senate and House health care bills.
Well, I would certainly support the resolutions. I do for the same reasons the governor enunciated just a minute ago. The health care plans that have been put forth in the U.S. House and also in the Senate both expand Medicaid to a significant degree at a time when all states are experiencing budget difficulties and would impose upon the states a much greater burden for supporting Medicaid enrollees. And the objection to those changes and the degree to which they cause distress in the states, I think, is obvious by virtue of Senator Nelson's deal that Nebraska be held harmless and other deals that senators made to get their vote on that, on the Senate bill alone. But in any case, the long and short of it is I would support those resolutions. Senate Bill 137 I have not seen. I know the Senate introduced a raft of new bills yesterday. I think there's about 240 total bills now between the House and the Senate, and roughly 40 or 50 were introduced yesterday on each side, and I have not seen that one. I have some question about the constitutionality of nullifying that and how far we'd be able to take the 10th Amendment. I do have concerns about the degree to which the federal government is exerting its authority over the states, and so it's not that I don't understand and empathize with the sentiment behind the sponsors of the bill. I'm just not sure about the constitutionality of it or really the content of it. I have not seen that or read it. Generally, the pattern has been to study the bills after they have cleared committee or after they've cleared the House, because the volume is such that it's difficult to plan for and determine a vote until I know that it's actually going to come to the Senate. And so as a simple form of time management, a necessary form of time management, I don't really study those bills that haven't passed out of Senate committee, nor those bills that haven't passed out of the House yet, because it would be a waste of time to study a bill upon which I would never have a chance to vote.
Sure. A follow-up on that, on the resolution, are you going to be watching and interested to see how Senator Heidefirm votes on that?
Well, I'll watch how all the senators vote. I don't really make judges of my own dependent upon what other senators do.
Chair, there's a movement upstairs to look at state investment money and whether or not money that the state invests in the retirement system or otherwise should be divested from companies that do substantial business in Iran and perhaps other countries that are on the short list of sponsors of terrorism or whatever. What are your thoughts on that?
I do know that when it comes to the investment of United States money or United States organizations or companies that are investing in nations that are not friendly to the United States and that are engaged in terrorism and are promoting terrorism, I have a real desire to see an attempt anyway to slow down those investments. Personally, I think that there is nothing wrong with the legislature sending a very strong message that the dollars that come from the taxpayers of South Dakota should be restricted in limited circumstances by the South Dakota Investment Council, specifically to those areas in which we have companies that clearly have invested in directly in those countries. And I don't have a problem with making it clear to the investment council that since we're the ones that are putting the money into this and that we recognize that they have obligations to get the best return that they can, but there are some things that are more important than return on investment. And if any of that money is going to a country which is turning around and using it against our soldiers and our citizens, then that's where we draw the line. So my feeling is that if it is properly worded and it can be enforced, meaning it cannot be so broadly written that you have to go back looking in areas that are so small and diminutive that it's just a matter of detail. If you're going that far, then you probably have something which is not tenable, which is not workable. But if it's specific to either a couple of companies that you know are currently investing in areas in Iran, as an example, then I have no objections to going back to the investment council saying there are some additional guidelines here that we want you to follow, because it is South Dakota taxpayer dollars in part that are being invested, and we will make this judgment call. I have no problem with that. But it has to be enforceable.
A question about something you said in your press conference last week. A couple different times you said that the budgets for the past several years have increased by less than 1%. Mm-hmm. And I went out and looked in the Bureau of Financial Management, and just from my sort of back of the envelope math, it looked like the increase that there were larger than 1%. And I was curious what I wasn't understanding or what.
No, I'd be happy to share with you. You can take a look at it because the numbers are clear. It's the general fund. The general fund of the state of South Dakota has increased by actually 0.85%. 0.85 of 1%, actually less than 1% per year in last year's budget, in this year's budget, or in the proposed budget for next year. And I'll be happy to show you specifically where we're talking the general fund. The total state budget has increased more than that because we've accepted federal funds and we've gone out and found other funds. We've accepted donations, all of which are included in the overall budget. But the general funds, which is the sales taxes, the proper or the video lottery funds, all the money that goes into the general fund has remained less than 1% in last year and this year and in the budget that I proposed for next year. Less than 1% growth in the general fund expenditures for the state of South Dakota. Furthermore, and during that same time, there's only a couple places you can actually go to put money into the general fund. And if you take a look, you'll find that during the same time period, there has been no use of our budget reserve last year, this year, either one of those 2 years. And that's during the 2 years in which we've had the worst recession since the Great Depression. And so we once again, when it comes to the budget, we believe that we've been doing a good job of slowing down the expenditure rates, but still recognizing that the challenge has been we really don't want to take money away from education. We have to continue to provide the federal required match on Medicaid. And if you look at just this next year, I think our total budget request went up by $51 million. But the amount that went into Medicaid was $52 million because everything else actually went down close to $1 million. So, it's a case of where we're not spending money that we don't have to spend. But it is in the it's in the general fund expenses for the state of South Dakota, which is the taxes that individuals do. And that's the money that comes actually from the state taxpayers.
Governor Dave Law,
yes, sir.
One more question. With regards to the economy, I was talking with Mayor Williams this week in Watertown. He said that we're seeing a market increase in the sales tax revenues and that businesses are beginning to rehire. Is that a trend that's going on across the state and maybe a sign the recession's easing?
Unfortunately, it is not. But one of the things that we're careful about is when we talk about 1 month at a time, sometimes since you report it on a month-to-month basis, you have to follow the overall trend. Because like right now with Christmas and the last couple of weeks, we've had major blizzards across South Dakota, and that's really slowed down a lot of the spending that you would have if people were out and actively engaged in a lot of travel and so forth. So rather than simply looking at the trend numbers for the last month only, we've just said let's get as much time under our belt as possible during this fiscal year before we actually identify what our base is going to be for next year. And we have not seen that trend of increasing sales taxes across the state. In part, we really think in part because the weather has been just miserable since the blizzard and then the ice storm. So right now we're not seeing that trend across the state. And we're still very, very concerned. I mean, we're watching it. We are concerned about being able to make our revenue projections for this year, and that's the part that we set the base for next year. So we're going to wait until we get our numbers in towards the end of this month to make a determination. That'll give us the December numbers, including Christmas. And then hopefully we'll get one more month in the January numbers in before the appropriators have to make a budget estimate or base their budget estimate on for the next year. So, but right now, no, we're not seeing that as an overall trend across the state, Dave.
Governor Tom Gabrielkiewicz from the Argus Leader, you led a very strong delegation to the SHOT Show recently in Las Vegas. Was that by design?
It was. When you say what was by design, leading a strong delegation or going to the SHOT Show?
Going to the SHOT Show.
It was intended. We'd had an invitation from the folks that actually put the SHOT Show on to come down and to share our story about South Dakota and our interest in developing a niche market for individuals that are actively engaged in the firearms industry. This is not something new. It's one of the niche markets that you've seen developing in the Watertown area, Clear Lake, and in Chamberlain, Sturgis, and Rapid City in particular. And a number of those folks have been very active participants and members of the Shooting Arms and Sports Association, the folks that actually put on the SHOT Show every year. And in the past, we've had our delegation out there, the folks from Tourism and State Development, and we co-op with different communities that are there to share their interest in terms of having firearms industry members come to their community. And this year they suggested that it might make a bigger impact yet if the governor were to come down for a day. And we had a chance to sit down and to meet with the vast majority of the major producers of firearms in the United States, some of whom already have a presence in South Dakota, Remington, with their ownership of Dakota Arms. But we also met with a number of other organizations that have expressed an interest in either adding to their existing facilities by adding a spot in South Dakota, or some actually looking at moving their facilities to our state in the future. With the new defense bill, you found that there were a number of South Dakota companies, a number of which had direct ties with our 2010 research facilities that are involved in the firearms industry or the defense industry, that have been successful in finding a spot in South Dakota. Our message is that we like the firearms industry. People in South Dakota have grown up with firearms. They like to hunt. And we think that the artisans and the technicians that are involved in the firearms industry would be great citizens in our state, and we think our citizens would be great to employ in this industry, because number one, they're used to it, and number two, they got a great work ethic, and our business climate is the best in the country. And it was just one more chance to get in front of them and to share it and to catch their attention. So, yeah, we spent a day out there, and I think we met with either 8 or 9 different companies specifically, and shared with them our interest. But it gave us a real good chance at their banquet. They introduced us and literally told everybody, listen, if you're looking for a place to go, South Dakota is probably the right spot. And by the way, the name of it is the Shooting Hunting Outdoor Trade Show. It's been on for years and years, and it's one of the largest trade shows in the United States. I think the day that I was there, they were expecting 88,000 people through to take a look at the different new products and making deals on who's buying which products and where they're going and so forth. So a heck of a good opportunity for us to share the spotlight with citizens from across South Dakota that were out there as well, promoting their individual communities.
And have you heard any response back from the manufacturers about coming to South Dakota?
What we have heard back, and in fact some of them around that day, is that depending on whether or not they get their contracts, yes, they're coming to South Dakota. It's a matter of whether or not they get awarded the contracts that they've been applying for. If some of the new patents that they've applied for are accepted by some of the other manufacturers that are there, they want to put their manufacturing facilities in South Dakota. Once again, as I shared with them, I never upstage them. When the time comes, they'll make their announcements. I know there's one that's already announced coming in from Europe. They are in Rapid City now. That announcement has been made. They've introduced us to some other folks from other parts of the United States that are also interested in moving into South Dakota. We were advised on the day that we were there that Remington fully expects that Dakota Arms will stay in Sturgis. They're not going to move them, and that they see it as a real growth opportunity for them in the high-end firearms industry for hunting. So, you know, we had some good visits there, and I think we've continued to send the message that we're the place that they want to do business in the future.
Thank you.
Yeah, in some cases, the defense contracts are a huge part of a number of these firearms organizations' business. And in some cases, they'll have a sole contract, or a contract may be opened up to where the Defense Department may be buying a particular gun from more than one organization. They may start out buying it only from Colt, or they may start out buying it only from like a Remington or a Winchester. And once that first agreement is done, then they'll allow other people to start manufacturing that particular model in their own locations as well, in their own firearms facilities. in our case, we've actually promoted and helped people find locations in South Dakota in which to do the manufacturing, testing, and research for products that they get contracts for through the Defense Department. And along with that, though, there's also the recreational side of it, and in which they'll have a new product being brought out, and it may very well be a case of where, whether it's not just the guns themselves or the tool themselves, the ammunition as well is something that is produced, and there's always a new way to create the ammunition or a new type or a new type of projectile. All of those are bits and pieces that all go together to make up the firearms industry, and this particular show has the individuals that create the projectiles, the individuals that do the powder, that do the primers, that do the brass, all of these folks that add to the firearms industry all are participate at this particular show because they sell their products back and forth to one another. So this is a chance for us to get in front of all of those different, and in a lot of cases they're not real big, and it may be only 10, 12 people that are working for them, but if they get a major contract, they may very well need to expand. In some cases, we have one person that's actually been out and been with us several different times. Their message to us was, we want to come to South Dakota. Tell us about your zoning ordinances. Do you have a zoning ordinance in place that stops us from putting up more than a 10,000-square-foot building? We said, not that we're aware of. Why? And they said, well, our state requires, in our community, we can't build a building more than 10,000 square feet. And so we're building multiple 10,000-square-foot buildings. And it's time we put it all under one roof. And we said, please, come to South Dakota. Let us help you. We'll find a way to not only roll out the red carpet for you, but we'll cut the red tape. We just won't cut corners. And their message is it's so nice to actually have somebody that's interested in helping us to be more effective and to be able to hire more people. And so they're looking at locations in South Dakota. Whether or not they get it will depend in many cases on whether or not they get the new renewal of a contract or a new contract with the Defense Department or with a major shooting arms provider, because they provide one part of a product that somebody else needs. But these are all artisans, and they are very technically astute, and they're looking for individuals that work well with their hands and individuals that have got engineering degrees, and that School of Mines has done a marvelous job of being represented with these different organizations, and people speak very highly of the individuals that not only study at School of Mines but also teach at the School of Mines in terms of what they can add to some of these projects. So that's been a great boon to us in Western South Dakota. Anything else? If not, thank you.